I would ask that you get a copy of last week's tape if you did not hear it, because I think it, what I'm going to do today, I think kind of spins off of that and probably kind of required for a little bit of the pre-setting of this. Ultimately, the problem we have in our culture making marriages work really doesn't start with marriage problems. Our failure to have marriages work in biblical and right ways are not as much about the marriage as we think they are. Through the years, I have said that my niche was marriage counseling that God sort of put me in, and that's kind of in some ways true. Somewhere around 2,500 or 3,000 couples in problem marriage counseling. But ultimately, I have to confess, I do very little marriage counseling. Because the problem is not normally marriage. The problem almost always on a marriage that is not working well is that the individual or individuals are having personal problems. And those personal problems are very seldom in itself is it a marriage issue. Last week, I said there are three systems by which marriages, by which we understand love. And depending on which system you have bought into, and you've bought into one, I promise you, you've bought into at least one of these. I mentioned that this is kind of a 1 to 3 year marriage. And if you buy into this one, you buy into what the culture's selling, but at the end of 1 to 3 years, you basically have a leave 'em kind of mentality. Now, you may still stay in the marriage, but you just sort of go your separate ways. There's a second system that our world has. And if you bought into this one, it's more of a 5 to 8 year marriage. And that 5 to 8 year marriage, again, may last 50 years, but you didn't have anything after 5 to 8 years that was really intimacy and really closeness. Now, in all fairness, there are people who move from these two false systems and move to the good one. But to do so is work. And to do so requires a real mental switch. It requires a systemic change, not just a superficial change. And there are great marriages in this room that started out as one of these two. But I don't mind telling you, it's a little like childbirth. It's a little traumatic. There's some trauma involved. Is it worth it? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, it's worth it. So I'm asking you not to abandon a marriage if you happen to find yourself as one of these two. But I'm going to tell you, you can't stay there. If you want a marriage that you want your children to have, the kind of marriage that's God-honoring, you've got to move it down to this one. Now, here's the problem, though. These first two systems, basically are marriages designed for fools. And that's really where I want to start, where I'm at today. The first two systems are marriages designed for fools. The third one, the one that God designed, is a marriage that is dependent upon you being wise. And I need to start with those two words. That's kind of the starting point, I guess. The word wise, if I just sort of take Book of Proverbs and say, what's God's aim for your life? God's aim for your life is not you be married. God's aim for you is you be wise. If you're wise, then you can handle singleness quite well. If you're wise, you can handle marriage quite well. But if you're not wise, you can't handle either one of them very well. God's desire is that you be wise. Now, the word wise, as we use it in our culture, probably is kind of a stretch for us. The word wise doesn't really mean knowledgeable per se and all of those sort of things, a good test taker or something along that line. Wise, ultimately, you take the book of Proverbs, take all the scriptures. Someone who is wise has three characteristics. These three traits are what make up wisdom. Conversely, someone who is a fool is someone who doesn't have at least one of these three traits and probably not very good at any of the three. And so the question is, are you wise or are you a fool? If you are a fool, you will believe that you constantly have marriage problems, that you have work problems, that you have parent problems, that you've got a brother and sister problem, that you've got neighbor problems, you've got kid problems. You may go ahead and sometimes anesthetize yourself so you don't feel it or sense it as much, but the fool is always struggling in life with other people. And when they move into a marriage, even someone they deeply love, they can't make it work, and they think it's their partner's fault. If you're a fool, you will struggle. You'll struggle. The three things that are really required, the three things that are really required for someone to be wise are these three. The wise individual is someone who has their own personal character and morality. Character or morality, what do you call it? The wise person is not someone who has a sense of morality that blows in the wind or changes according to moodiness or changes according to circumstances and situations. The person who's wise is someone who has borrowed from God what God's character and morality is. And they are someone who can stand on their own two feet with their own personal morality. The wise person is someone who has their own personal contentment. Contentment is that sense of, I like who I am in the Lord. Yes, there's parts of my life I need to improve on and change and grow in, but I like being a child of the King. I like who I am. I'm content in my relationship and my walk with Him. So they have their own personal morality, they have their own personal contentment, and then thirdly, they have their own personal sense of joy, happiness. The person who is wise is the person who's not having to borrow constantly on something from the outside to give them joy. There's somebody who can get up in the morning and whistle on their way to work, for lack of a better term, and whistle on the way home from work. Doesn't mean they're not hard times in life, but I have my own happiness and I'm not borrowing it. Now, again, I know I'm laying the groundwork here, so stay with me. The fool does not have those three things. The fool has a much sloppier sense of character. It's more inconsistent. The fool is much more moody as far as contentment is concerned. And the fool is someone that their happiness is something they're still pursuing with some regularity. Either that or they give it up entirely and just sort of shut down and assume you can't have it. Wisdom and foolishness. When you came into the world, when I came into the world, we came in without any of those three things. I didn't have a single bit of my own personal character. I didn't have a single bit of my own contentment. I didn't have a single bit of my own happiness or joy. I came in the world completely horizontal on those three things, for lack of a better term. And God's goal for my life is that I grow up and be conformed to the image of His Son. And then in my relationship with my King and my Redeemer, that I can stand on my own two feet with Him alone and have character and contentment and joy. Well, the process of life is just the journey of moving from here to here. That's all life really is. Julie stopped by Kansas City yesterday and they made the comment that Ian, my grandson, he's about 4 months old now, something along that time line, said he wasn't very content yesterday. Well, what that basically means is that when we came into the world as babies, somebody else provided all that for us. So what did they do with Ian yesterday? Well, they're carrying him around, they're patting him and they're throwing him in the air and, you know, those sort of things. And, you know, all the kinds of things you do with a baby when he doesn't have it. All of us borrowed, when we first came into the world, we borrowed from our parents every bit of morality, character, and contentment we had. All right? Then we began to grow up a little bit. And we hit a stage of life, maybe it's 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age, 6 years of age, 7 years of age. We still borrowed from our parents very, very much, but we begin to borrow from our adolescent friends that are around us. Why are, and the joke, why are second grade girls so dependent upon one another? Why do you watch second grade girls like move like amoebas out to the playground, amoebas to the bathrooms? And, you know, I mean, why when this fourth grade girl gets access to the telephone to call her friends, why is it Katie bar the door? She is on the phone and continually, you know, then if the parents will let her with these fourth grade girls, why? Well, we just like it. No, no, no. Why do you like it? Well, they don't know themselves, but the answer is they're borrowing. The reason little girls run around like little girls do is little girls are borrowing. They get their sense of happiness, their sense of contentment, and even their sense of character. They're borrowing from one another. Why is it that little boys... I mean, the classic example, you can have the perfect little boy. I mean, he is the sweetest little boy. He is a fourth grade boy. He is a jewel. I mean, nobody better than this little boy. Until Tuesday night. And on Tuesday night, he got in with another set of different boys that he doesn't normally run with, and they're shooting street lights out with BB guns. And he's just right in the middle of them. Why? This horrible monster, this hypocritical kid? No. No, he's a borrower. And so whatever crowd he's in, he's borrowing. Now, I'm not being offensive with this. He's just still in the foolish stage, which means he doesn't have his own character, his own contentment, his own happiness, so he borrows. Now, all of that is normal. That's what parenting is. By the way, absent parents force your children to borrow from all the wrong places too soon. Do not be absent parents. Number two, borrowing from friends is perfectly fine. It's what we do. It's how we learn. Second rule of parenting. Make sure you know who your kids are running with because they're not just friends. That is the pool by which they're borrowing and developing their own character, their own contentment, their own sense of joy. I have no problem with those things up to that point. Here's where I go bananas, and the rest of you do too. Not all of you, perhaps, but you ought to. Our culture then does something really asinine. You couldn't hardly be more stupid than our culture is on this. We created Ken and Barbies. And we created Ken and Barbies not just because little girls like to play with dolls. We created a Ken and Barbie, and I don't mean that I have nothing against the little figurines, you know, little plastic. That's not my issue. My issue is the whole cultural concept that now instead of playing with dolls, we play with relationships. And so what happens is the culture somewhere along the line used to say, no, you're not happy. No, you're not content yet. No, you don't have your own morality. You're still moving from the fool stage to the wise stage. So you borrow from your parents. You borrow from these friends. And now about age 14, 15, 16, 17, you start borrowing from a boyfriend or girlfriend. And so we start borrowing what we do not have. And we label it, the whole thing, as being in love and falling in love and the whole dating nonsense when it is nothing more than takers and users and finding artificial means that sidetrack me from moving from the fool to wise. Our culture uses relationships to solve what's not right in us. If I had my perfect way that I would raise my kids, and I realize you can't do it in an ideal way, but if I had my perfect way, I would invest in my kids and I would pour my life into them and I would pick very carefully and help them to be around godly friends, but somewhere in that 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old stage, I would pick them up and drop them on a deserted island by themselves. And I'm serious. I'm serious. I'd pick them up, drop them on a deserted island, and I would not want to go back until my 14-year-old daughter or 14-year-old son or could wake up in the morning and know who they are, because they see the reflection in God. And I know who I am. I'm a child of the King. I'm not a reflection off something, some stupid TV show like Saved by the Bell. I'm not some reflection off some kind of movie. I am not my culture. I am a child of the King. My character, we borrow from Him. I wouldn't want to go back and pick them up till they could wake up in the morning and say, I like being me. Oh, there's things about me that need to grow and change on, but I like being me. I want to be Megan. I want to be Katie. I want to be Troy. What are my kids' names? I like being who I am. And God, you made me and you formed me in my mom's womb. And God, you have purposes for my life. And I like being me. I wouldn't want to go back to my 15-year-old could wake up in the morning and whistle when they first got up and sort of attack the day with a little joy. And at the end of the day, I mean, you notice, how many here recognize from your own life, and certainly raising of your kids, how many recognize that the adolescent stage has a lot of anger in it? Anybody ever notice that? Why? And the answer is because we are still fools. Now, again, I'm not mad at anybody. It's how it's supposed to be in the growing up. But the problem is that relationships sabotage. And instead of moving from the fool stage, we just move to the relationship stage. The number one drug in America is not alcohol. The number one drug in America is not methamphetamines. The number one drug in America is not crack or something along that line. The number one drug in America is another person. We use other people to fix our problems. And so the average girl, if she doesn't think she's pretty enough, skinny enough, talented enough, well-liked enough, the average girl in America who's not exactly, kind of got a hole in the middle of her chest. But I'd just be happy if the right guy did love me. I'm kind of aimless out here, and I kind of got a void in my life, but I'd be content if I were. The average guy in America is sort of stumbling through, not really sure what to do with his life. He's got a hole in his chest, but I'd be happy if the right girl just really loved me. And so what you end up is the first two systems that I described last week are ultimately nothing more than marriages created for people who want to be fools. That's all they are. I've told this story several times here in the last 3, 4, 5 months. But I walked through our own foyer up here. I walked through our own foyer last spring. And there was a little girl sitting up there on one of the chairs or a couch. She's a second or third grade girl. As I walk by her, I can see she's crying, and I know who she is. So I went over and sat down beside her, and I said, sweetheart, are you okay? And she's sitting there, and that lip's just bouncing and quivering. I said, honey, what's wrong? And then she said, Mr. Garris, this is second or third grade girl. Mr. Garris, none of the boys in class will go with me. Now, you're trying to keep from smiling at a point like that. And then you realize, wait a second, this is deeper, because she finished it with this sentence. Mr. Garris, and in our class, if none of the boys will go with you, you're nobody. You're nobody. I know some of you will not appreciate what I'm about to say, but I'm going to tell you, there's nothing more devastating to people's lives than dating early. I'm being honest. The same way the alcoholic chases the bottle, the same way the drug addict chases the next hit. So too, I have a God-given void in my life as I move from foolishness to wisdom, and it's intended to call me to Him. It's intended to call me to wholeness in Him. And by the way, the word wisdom ultimately means wholeness. And while God has a hole in my life that's intended to call me to Him and to find my wholeness in Him, so like a mirror, I finally begin to reflect Him with less and less distortion, so that my contentment and my happiness and my morality is Him. The world is saying, no, come this way. You'll find it in a relationship. You'll find it in a relationship, and you'll find it in a relationship. And so fools get married. And fools date. Your problem in most marriages are not the marriage. The problem is the reason my wife does not satisfy me is because my wife could not satisfy me. There's nothing more idolatrous than trying to put a person in the place where my living God ought to be. And so we start playing this stupid game, this game of resentment, this game of bitterness, this game of anger, this game of withdrawal, this game of I'll get even because my relationships are not satisfying me. And we start blaming our wives and blaming our children and blaming our husbands and blaming everybody else because somehow the hole in my chest is not coming together and it's you. And the fool does not see it through any other eyes but his own. And the fool is keep going, yeah, I have my weaknesses, but you sure handle my weaknesses very well. If you handle my weaknesses better, I'd be doing better. And the fool just keeps playing over and over and over again and keep lashing out. There is nothing any more dangerous in this world than a four-year-old boy with a plastic bat in the middle of the living room. He is swinging that sucker everywhere he goes. A four-year-old boy in a plastic bat. But that's precisely what's happening in tons of our homes. We never learned to move from being a fool to being wise. And you'll fall deeply in love with him or her, and they meet your needs, and everything's marvelous for a little while. And then the realities of life hit, and I'm resentful. Don't let your children date very early. The Garrises didn't do everything right. My goodness, there's so many things we should have done different and better in our raising of our kids and so forth. But I'll tell you one thing. We outlaw the word boyfriend and girlfriend in our home. Not just the use of it, the concept of it. Until late high school. We outlawed it. For 30 years, I've watched. You know who the most emotionally messed up people in this crowd will be? It'll be those of you who started dating early because somehow you got your nectar of life from somebody else. Now, do you have to stay messed up? No, you don't have to stay messed up. And maybe you've moved on past that and finally grown up. But I'm going to tell you, there is nothing this culture is promoting that is more damaging than early dating. It is horrible. You say, well, I know an exception. Yes, I'm sure there's exceptions, but the exceptions normally prove the rule. Be very, very carefully. Be careful as you approach this concept. The way God designed it, I do believe, is that somebody starts out foolish, but that's okay. It's what we're supposed to be. That's how it's right. And we learn to stand on our own two feet with him, and we have our wholeness or wisdom in him. Perfectly? No, not at all, but wise. And two wise people can choose to love one another and have a great and marvelous marriage the whole of their life. But wisdom is required. Some of you ought to go home and say to your spouse, sweetheart, I owe you an apology. I put so much pressure on you the last 3 or 4 years. I've been so unsettled. I've been so hurt. I've been so this. I've been so that. I put pressure on you to fix things, and I realize our marriage is not the problem. You're not even the problem. I'm trying to find in you what I never found in my Lord. I never found wisdom. Now, you don't have to get out of a marriage to do that. Last hour I was preaching this, and as I finished, a lady walked up to me, and she would not mind if I used her name. I know she wouldn't. She'd be her whole story she would tell you, but she sat there and she said, Randy, the first 10 years of our marriage, I was a fool, and my husband was wise. And my husband just kept loving me, and my husband just kept investing in me, and my husband in his wisdom patiently waited. And she said, that first 10 years, I thought it was him and this and that, but I finally realized one day I was the fool. And she said, after the 10-year mark, I finally got some wisdom. And she said, she took both of my hands at the end of this last service. She said, you tell them you tell them the sweetest marriage is possible when you finally grow up yourself. Boy, ring a bell for anybody? If it's a black church, would it get an amen somewhere? I could speak of Julie and I in pretty honest terms. Julie and I have a very, very good marriage. God, by His grace. And my wife loves me, and if I died today, I don't mind telling you, I could go to my grave saying I was a loved man. And I want my kids to have the same kind of marriage that Julie and I have. I can say that honestly. But hear me on this. While we have a good marriage and I like what it is and I like the closeness and I like the tenderness, I am married to a wise woman. And she has loved me when I wasn't wise. We'd have been in more trouble if I was married to a fool. Because in my foolishness as a 4-year-old boy with a bat in the room, had I been married to a foolish woman who also had a bat in the room, we'd have struggled and we'd have been saying, well, we've had marriage problems. No, we wouldn't have. We'd been having personal problems that were impacting our marriage. Because my wife is a wise woman, she has her happiness and her contentment and her morality and her walk with the Lord, and we share a life together that's sweet. If anything ever happened to me, if I keel over a heart attack before the day is over, or some of you shoot me or something along the line, I want you to know my wife would be perfectly fine. My wife would grieve at least 2 or 3 days. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm pretty confident. But I want you to know, after my wife has gone through the stage of being a typical grieving widow, my wife would be perfectly fine. Because I am not her drug of choice. I am her husband who she chooses to love. Anything ever happened to me, Julie could live single the rest of her life and be perfectly content. Or Julie could choose to remarry. And she'd be free to remarry, but she wouldn't have to remarry to be okay. If she remarried, it's because she wanted to, not because she had to. I want to say this again. If you have to be in a relationship to be okay, you'll never be in an okay relationship. Never, ever. System 1 and System 2, the ones I talked about last week, those two systems are nothing more than systems designed by and for fools so we don't have to grow up and be whole. About scared Lynn Conover to death last hour. She's responsible for kind of keeping us on time a little bit. Last hour I commented at this point in time. Now that's my introduction. Now I'd like to get to the sermon. I do have to say this next part. Then what is God's design for a marriage? What should a marriage look like? I have to begin with point number one. A godly marriage begins not with the marriage, but with the individual. Am I wise? And if I'm not wise, I've got some unfinished homework to do. I need to find some godly and wise men around me and say, you need to help me because I have stumbled around as a fool too long. If I'm not wise, I need to sit down and take my wife's hands and say, sweetheart, I know there are things in your life that are not as they ought to be either. I know that. But I'm going to tell you, our problem is not those things. Our problem is I've not been wise. My problem is I've been more of a fool than I ought to be, and I'm going to need your help to learn to grow up. I need to learn to change. Quite frankly, in my growing up, my wife was indispensable in that process. My wife has been a gift of God to me in some areas of wisdom. I couldn't borrow hers, but by the same token, she modeled, she coached, and she taught. A good biblical marriage starts not with the vows you make to each other. They start with personal wisdom. Your own happiness, your own contentment, and your own morality in being formed out of the dust of the ground and in the image of God. The second thing that's required in a covenant marriage, then, is a comprehension of what you are to do in your marriage. We were all born with the instinct to want to love and be loved. The wise person understands that the one that drives all of that is the instinct to love. The fool reverses it and believes that what drives it all is if I'm just loved enough, then I'm capable of loving. The fool flips him around. The wise person puts him in the right order. Time is so short, I'm going to have to cut this down significantly, but let me tell you what happened the day that we got married. No, it didn't literally happen, but this is what happened. I understood the day I held my wife's hands in front of a crowd in Waukeeta, Oklahoma. And I'm holding my wife's hands, and in a sense, this is exactly what happened. In a sense, I verbalized. My vows were never with Julie. You need to understand that. In a covenant marriage, my vows were never with Julie. My vows were with Julie's creator. My vows were with my creator. And because I'd found someone wise and chosen that I want to love someone for the rest of my life, my vows went more like this. I am holding her hand, but I am saying, at least mentally, Heavenly Father, I think I love her. I believe I love her. But Lord, how do you know about these things? I don't know. How do you know? I don't know. I'm some goofy looking 19 or 20 year old boy, you know, looks over his head. But holding her hands, I basically said, but Heavenly Father, I know I love you. And Heavenly Father, out of love for you, out of love for you, I'm going to take this woman home. And Heavenly Father, I will be your ambassador in her life for her good on your behalf as long as I live. Lord, you brought her in the world, and Lord, you'll take her out. But Lord, I've committed myself that I will be your servant in her life. And it took a while for me to learn, what's that mean to be an ambassador of God, a servant of God, in my wife's life on the Lord's behalf? But that's ultimately where this all starts. A covenant marriage is about I have a partnership with the living God that the individual in my home will be cared for on God's behalf as my act of worship to Him. There were days that Julie was easy to love. And there are days that Julie is like anyone else, be saved by grace. There are days I woke up and felt tender to her and wanted to love her in gentle and kind ways. There were days I woke up more on the fool side of the bed and I just ticked about this or that or hurt or upset. But my vow was never with Julie. My vow was with God. And the greatest act of worship that would start and end each day is some sense of, God, I am your servant in her life, whether I feel like it or whether she deserves it. It's almost irrelevant. Heavenly Father, is an act of worship, invest in her life. It is a funny thing, but a covenant marriage is built upon sweet words like responsibility and duty and honor and valor and courage and commitment. There's a couple, the other end of the building, married, I think, 68 years. I think it's 68. I lose track. I need to go ask them exactly the number. They can still remember. You sit down and you ask them. You ask them what the core of their marriage is, and their answer is, you just do the right thing. You do the right thing. You do the right thing for one another. Oh, what horrible slavery is that? To be committed to for 68 years, the key to your marriage is just do the right thing? Oh, what a horrible thing to have. Man, is that ever like being handcuffed to one another? You got to do the right thing today. Words like responsibility and duty and honor and courage and commitment. Boy, what awful words those are. But there's a divine secret. There's an absolute twinkle in God's eye. There's a powerful secret. One you'll never ever discover until you do it. Ned's love for Linda doesn't have very much to do on how Linda treats Ned. I guarantee it's true. His love for Linda has very little to do on how Linda treats Ned. You see, when Ned wakes up in the morning and is a servant of the living God, says, I will commit to her today and I will invest in her today. I will take care of her today. Jesus' words will be fulfilled. God almost winks and nudges the angels and says, watch this. Because one of the ways God wired us, Jesus stated it this way, where your investment is, there will your heart be also. And when Ned begins to invest in her in sold out kinds of ways, Ned will have a deeper heart and affection for her than he ever dreamed. She could never do enough to win his heart, as much as his investing in her will cause his heart to follow. In 28 years of marriage, any time in my own marriage that I thought my marriage was getting a little flat or a little stale, any time in the 28 years that I thought, oh man, this is just kind of becoming routinism, the fool in me immediately wanted to launch to, I wish Julie would straighten up. I wish she'd sure do something better or more. It's her, I'm sure. Because that's where the fool's mind always goes. But in every case, and I can tell you without exception, that had little or nothing to do with my own heart. What had actually happened, any time my marriage became stale or flat or routinism, you could almost guarantee that Randy had either gotten his feelings hurt and had kind of backed out of investing in her, or Randy had got busy and distracted and just kind of stopped investing in her, or Randy had gotten angry and decided he was going to teach her a lesson or something and had stopped investing. I mean, a thousand things you can think of, but what happened when you pull your investment out, your heart begins to wane. So what do? The answer is, you wake up and say, God, my vow was to you, and I've been acting like a fool, and I want to become a wise person again. And you begin to invest in your mate, and you start doing the right thing. And lo and behold, a fresh wash would come over you of deeper affection and tenderness and love than you ever dreamed or ever had. That's why old couples tell you it just gets better through the years, because their investment has grown richer through the years. A covenant marriage is a marriage in which I recognize I am God's servant in my partner's life on his behalf. And the divine secret of God is where my investment is, there will my heart be. This morning, I don't mind telling you, you need to be wise and you need to be committed. And if you're wise and you're committed, you'll have the kind of marriage, at least on your side. You may have a better marriage than your partner has. That's true. You'll have the kind of heart for your marriage and the kind of marriage the neighbors would beat the door down to try to get in their own home. And it comes off those simple things. This morning, I invite you to covenant marriage.